Welcome to Solari Special Reporter AudioCast. This is your host, Deke Kennedy. Today's AudioCast is on jury nullification, a very important legal doctrine that protects against government's abuse of power. The exercise of the right to nullify by a jury can be noticed to a government agency to exercise its discretion not to enforce a particular law. It can also be a message to the legislature that it is time to change a law. There is a right to jury nullification in both criminal trials through the Sixth Amendment to the Bill of Rights and civil trials through the Seventh Amendment. This audio cast will focus on nullification only in criminal trials. Taking us through this legal doctrine is Wisconsin attorney Elizabeth Rich, a litigator with over 30 years experience in the court. Elizabeth has her own law practice in Plymouth, Wisconsin, and also serves as president of both Andrew's Voice, a nonprofit dedicated to rectifying injustices in the area of involuntary civil commitment, and the Food Freedom Foundation, another nonprofit that supports the work of the Farm Consumer Legal Defense Fund and other like-minded organizations. FTC-LDF is a grateful beneficiary of Solari's Take Action crowdfund campaign. A heads up to our listeners that we are focusing on jury nullification as it applies to Wisconsin law. The law on jury nullification is similar, but not always the same in other states as it is in Wisconsin. So those interested in pursuing this topic further should find out what the constitutional, statutory, or case law is on jury nullification in your state. So let's get started. Elizabeth, welcome to the Solari AudioCast. Okay, yes, second time. You were previously on a food series podcast, but we'll kick off this one just with a general question to you. How would you define jury nullification?
Jury nullification means that the jury has the right to refuse to convict if the jury believes the conviction would be unjust. While we're addressing the definition, I think it's also appropriate to say that jury nullification has, to me, a pejorative connotation that I think is inappropriate. I think a better term is jury independence, because a jury that considers whether a law is just or a punishment is too severe is acting as the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, intends. So it's not nullifying the jury function, but rather carrying out the jury function.
If you could give us a quick description of the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution.
Well, the Sixth Amendment does not specifically say juries have a right to nullify or juries have a right to decide the fact in the law. It just says that a person accused of a crime has a right to a jury trial. So you have to, scholars who have looked at this issue have gone back to the writings from the late 1700s when the Bill of Rights was authored and ratified, and they've looked at cases from that era and scholarly writings from that era, and that's where they've derived that the jury clearly had the right, the framers intended and drafted the Sixth Amendment to provide juries with the right to independence and to independently decide the facts and the law.
There are really three reasons given for nullifying a jury verdict for the most part. There's one would be that the law itself was unjust. Another would be that the law was unjust as applied to the facts of the case. And a third would be that the punishment was excessive to the crime. In this audio cast, we're going to go mainly over the first two, but if you could talk a little bit about the third one, just the history and how the reason that's been used as a reason to nullify.
Sure. Back in the early days of colonial independence, and well, at the time the Constitution was written, this notion of freedom from arbitrary power was very fresh in the minds of the framers, because wealthy English governors would put into place laws to protect their property interests and impose unduly harsh punishments like death for stealing. And this was clearly intended to protect the wealthy and discourage any kind of challenge to that status quo. In those early days, when someone was going to be tried and convicted for stealing from a wealthy landowner and the penalty would be death, juries more and more started to say no. They would stand up and say, no, we're not going to convict because we know that the penalty is going to be too harsh.
All right, well,
we had actually recently in 2019, there was a highly publicized case, Scott Warren. If you remember that, he's the one who provided food and water to undocumented aliens in the Arizona desert.
Right.
And he was charged with harboring an alien, and that carries prison time of 20 years. So in that case, it was a hung jury, and he wound up, and the government wound up not pursuing a second trial. But those jurors said, no, you know, the punishment doesn't fit the crime, and we're not going to convict. At least half of them did.
All right. Let's get in a little more to the origins and the rationale behind the doctrine. So if you could just explain to the listeners how this has been a debate going on for hundreds and hundreds of years and what really led to the doctrine of jury nullification in this country.
In the early days, it was fairly common that, first of all, judges routinely instructed juries that they had the power to decide both the law and the facts. Sometimes they would discourage it. There's always been a little bit of a paternalistic or elitist attitude. I guess I'm putting my own opinion out there on that judges are smarter and more well-versed in the law and better able to determine which law is applicable in a particular case. That's always been an attitude that's out there. But in the early days, in the 1700s and 1800s, courts would routinely instruct juries that they had the ability to decide both the facts and the law. You know, these are all, we know this from old cases, the courts and scholarly writings that document this. But gradually during the 1800s, the doctrine fell from favor. And courts started to not to provide the instruction. And that led to the Scarf case in 1895. SPARF case. So in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was going too far to say that that a defendant had a right to instruct the jury that it had the power to nullify. Justice Harlan's opinion said that public and private safety alike would be in peril if the principle be established that juries in criminal cases may of right disregard the law as expounded to them by the court and become a law unto themselves.
So basically, it was saying that the judge had the option to instruct the jury about their right to judge both the law and the facts, but there was no obligation on him to do so.
That's right.
Okay. And what is the Wisconsin law on jury nullification?
In Wisconsin, the first case was the Merkerd case, and that court held that was an old case that was more favorable. So the court said, by convicting the defendant of one rather than both charges, the jury may have acted out of sympathy or exercised a form of jury nullification based upon their sense of fairness and justice. Whatever reasoning the jury employed, their determination must be respected by this court. So that was consistent with rulings of the time that respected the jury's right to decide both the law and the fact, even if they were motivated by what some jurists might say were improper motives like sympathy. But then in 1991, the leading case now that's cited is State v. Bierkus. And I've seen citations to this case that that say it stands for the proposition that jury nullification may not be discussed at trial at all. And I think a lot of judges believe that. That's an overly broad reading of the case. What the court said in Bierkus was the trial court did not abuse its discretion in disallowing defense counsel to argue that the jury could decline to follow the law. So that's very different than saying you can't discuss it. The court just said, defense counsel said, we want to raise it in closing arguments, and the court said no. And then the appeal said, the court, by making that ruling, the court denied the defendant the right to have the jury instructed on nullification, and the appellate court said, no, that it's okay, that's within the discretion of the trial court. So essentially the same as the federal court ruling in Sparf.
Right. Can a juror in Wisconsin be punished for exercising jury nullification, or can they be punished for informing other jurors about the right of nullification during deliberation?
Generally, no. I did come across an article that said that in more than one recent case, jurors during deliberations reported to the judge that one of their own, one another juror, was discussing nullification and expressing an intent to nullify. And in both of those cases, apparently, the judge, this is during deliberations but before verdict, the judge substituted that juror with an alternate. So I was very surprised by that. The article didn't give a citation to the cases, something I'd like to follow up on to see what justification was given for that.
Right. So even though the judge can't punish the juror, usually that's when that a juror favors jury nullification, they can replace that juror before the final deliberation by the jury, correct?
Apparently they can. Like I said, I'm interested in doing more research on that because it seems to me that that's inappropriate.
Say, unlike the case you just mentioned, the jurors don't say anything to the judge about one of the jurors wanting to nullify during deliberation, but the judge still suspects that maybe one of the jurors has exercised that right, say if it's a hung jury. What is the law in Wisconsin about the secrecy of the jury? And on what grounds can the judge actually compel the members of the jury to say whether the verdict was based on jury nullification?
My opinion is that the jury has the power to exercise its independence, and the judge has no power to stop it.
Right. Okay. So what about from the defense attorney standpoint? Suppose he tells the jury during the trial that they do have the right to judge the law of the case. What kind of penalty can, what would the punishment be, or could he be punished for doing that?
There's no penalty for doing that unless the statement is contrary to a prior ruling of the court. So all of this case law says there's no right to have an instruction from the judge about nullification. Most prosecutors in, I think, every criminal case I've encountered, the prosecutor will file a motion in limine, which is a motion made before the trial begins out of the hearing of the jury. That motion in limine will request an order from the judge prohibiting defense counsel from mentioning jury nullification during the trial or during opening or closing arguments.
Okay.
That's the way it's most commonly done. And then if the defense counsel were to defy that order, he could be held in contempt. So that would be the sanction. And contempt carries jail time or fines or both.
Right. Getting back to the jurors, there's no requirement, just to be sure, ever from them having to state why they voted the way they did.
No. Many times, counsel on both sides will want to hear, for educational purposes or curiosity, what the rationale was for the decision the jury made, but they're never obligated to discuss that.
Right. And you get these cases, these criminal cases, where one juror is holding out, and eventually the judge might declare a hung jury. What happens next, or what is the law on hung juries and what the prosecution can do after one in Wisconsin?
Generally speaking, you know, the hung jury is not the same as an acquittal. So the government has, it's not double jeopardy if the government decides to retry the case. They have to just make that decision whether, you know, sometimes whether the witnesses will still be around, whether strategically it's advisable. So they can retry the case.
Okay. All right. At this point, I think we're going to go into a jury nullification case that you litigated. I guess it was about 7 years ago, just Wisconsin versus Vernon Hershberger. And we're going to look at the strategy, jury nullification strategy during that case, from the standpoint of what the jurors could do, what the you and your co-counsel, Glenn Reynolds, did during the case, as well as how just people who weren't part of the case, but just supporters of Vernon helped and in what I would call the court of public opinion. So I guess first off, if you could just tell us the, give us a background of the case and tell us the charges that were brought against Vernon.
Vernon Hershberger is a formerly Amish farmer who at the time ran a buyer's club, a private club where he distributed food products produced at his farm and elsewhere to members of the club. And the products included unpasteurized milk, the sale or distribution of which is generally prohibited in Wisconsin. There are some exceptions. One of the exceptions is owners. Owners of the animals are entitled to purchase or take the milk from the animals they own. The state accused Vernon, and the state's primary motivation in pursuing Vernon, I believe, was the raw milk issue. That's the primary motivation. They didn't really care that he was selling goji berries to members of the public. No, that wasn't the issue. But he was running a what they called a store. There were products in the store with price tags on them. And he was distributing or selling dairy products from the unpasteurized milk, including the milk itself, yogurt, kefir, butter, all of those things. So he was charged with four misdemeanors. The three that we're focusing on are the licensing charges. So charged with operating a food establishment without a license, operating a dairy plant without a license, and producing milk without a license. So those were three things that the state said he licenses he needed and didn't have. It was somewhat disingenuous because, as I said, I believe the real motivator was the raw milk sales, and there is no license in Wisconsin for selling raw milk. So he couldn't get a license to do what he was doing. But the state tried to portray it as, geez, you know, this is a scofflaw who just doesn't want to pay $125 for a license. He doesn't think the rules apply to him. That's the way the state presented their case.
And just to describe how difficult a case this was to really win on a littler interpretation of the law. Basically, the law in Wisconsin says if you have a retail, if you sell or distribute food at all, you're a retail food establishment. In other words, if you sell, you know, an apple pie to your neighbor for $5, you're a retail food establishment, technically, the way the law reads. And
that's right. It's very broad.
Right. And if you're a milk producer, if you have one or more dairy animals and sell or distribute that milk, you need a milk producer license. So technically, if you give a gallon of milk to your neighbor across the street, you violated the law.
That's right.
And and the dairy plant, if you manufacture any dairy product, which would include bottling milk, that would be under the dairy plant permit, and even give that to someone, you're violating the law again.
That's right.
Okay.
So yes, it was a tough case because arguably Vernon's actions did violate those laws. We had to come at it. We tried making a public-private distinction in the pretrial rulings did not go our way on that because the Wisconsin Food Code talks about distributing to members of the public. So we tried to make a public-private distinction that this is a private buying club, so the actions didn't violate it, and there were pretrial rulings that just didn't let us go there.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to get into that just before the trial, what was happening, because it just, my memory is the judge just ruled for the state again and again on any motions you made to establish a public-private distinction, or if you could give people an idea just on, he even prohibited certain words from being introduced or terms being introduced during the trial.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to say freedom, independence, or raw milk. And I do think those rulings wound up hurting the state because even though we tried to instruct our witness, we prepared our witnesses and we said there's certain things, that words that are not allowed to be used. These are just normal lay people and they were talking about something they're very passionate about. So they would drop one of the words, freedom. Objection, says the state. And then the jury has to file out, you know, they'd all get up and leave. And then we have to argue the objection out of their presence. And that must have happened 15 times.
Right.
Someone says raw milk, objection. And I think, at that point, the jury started to figure something was up here. Something was being kept from them.
So
information that might be helpful in making a decision. And I don't think that helped the state's case.
And when it came to the issue of jury nullification, you said they introduced a motion in the pretrial to make sure that you could not bring that up, correct?
That's correct. And just like almost every motion they made, the court upheld it.
Right. So what was the legal term for that motion?
A motion in limine.
Right. Okay. So, you know, by this time, this case had already received a lot of publicity, even though we're still a ways away from the actual trial date. And there was a lot going on in the court of public opinion, from specifically as it pertains to jury nullification. Could you, just describe what was going on in Sauk County at the time you were winding your way through all these endless pretrial hearings? Just as far as, you know, the handing out of leaflets, that type of thing.
Yeah, Vernon had incredibly strong public support. I don't recall how many members he had in his buying club, but it was a high number. And it was people across the country. So residents of Sauk County, I think, led the charge. And the primary purpose of what they were doing was to raise awareness of the case, that this is what's happening. The state is criminally charging a farmer for providing food to members of this community. And there was quite a bit of public outcry over it. During the trial, just as an aside, during the trial, many local businesses had big signs put up in their picture windows in support of Vernon and donated food to the people at the trial and to the lawyers. So it was widespread support. But before the trial, leaflets were, I believe there were 40,000 residents of Sauk County. And there were donations to cover the cost of producing, I think they produced 40,000 leaflets with a goal of going to every single door in the county. And I don't know if I'm sure they didn't connect with everybody, but they did a pretty impressive effort. And so the leaflets described jury nullification and what the power was. And this is permissible because the jury had not yet been impaneled. You have to be careful about taking action like that once the jury's impaneled and there's specific jurors identified. You can't wait for lunch break and hand out leaflets as they exit the courtroom. You could be charged with tampering with the jury if you took that action. But what these residents did was just try to raise awareness. There were letters to the editor. There were articles in the newspaper. You authored one for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Just generally speaking, and there was a lot of publicity. So I was interviewed by the New York Times, the London Times, the Washington Post. It was a big story.
This was all before the trial, correct?
There was some before and some after. Yeah, so I could, there's not much, I had to be very careful about what I said before.
Right. So what basically did you say when you were interviewed before the trial?
That was an effort just to talk, really to kind of talk about what Vernon was doing, to humanize him to the audience, and then to talk about the charges. I'm allowed to talk about the charges and the law, but what I could not do, I was not going to mention jury nullification even before the motion in limine, and certainly not after. I also, you can't use your interview with the press to get out in the public something that you would not be able to introduce in court. So I had to be very careful, but I talked generally about raw milk laws across the nation. We hadn't been prohibited from saying raw milk at that point.
Right. You weren't in court anyway, right? Yeah.
Right.
So, it's just, I think especially what his club members or just other supporters did, passing around all these leaflets, is just a good example of how successful jury nullification is often about a lot more than just the attorneys, the defendant, and the jurors. It's about getting the word out however you can. Now we're going to go to the trial itself and just what the impact just passing all these leaflets had, especially on one aspect of the trial, which is the jury selection. I think from what we've talked about before, they went through a minimum of 90 prospective jurors, and might have even been over 100. And I think a lot of that was because the word was out about jury nullification. So if you could talk about, just that process, what happened during the jury nullification in the case, just what a juror who is aware, who's knowledgeable about jury nullification and thinks a trial he has a chance to hear involves an unjust treatment of the defendant, what they can do to increase their chances of being impaneled in that jury?
Well, they have to answer the questions truthfully. There's just no getting around that. And so the strategy from the defense lawyer's point of view during voir dire, this issue is generally less is more. We felt that we probably had the sympathy of the majority of the people in the community. But if the judge is going to say, can you be impartial? That's his question. And a lot of people said, no, my mind's made up. And then we were like, darn it. So those are questions that the prosecutor and the judge are going to ask to try to determine whether there are jurors out there who might attempt to nullify. And all the defense counsel can really do is sit tight because, the jurors have to tell the truth. We lost a lot of jurors that would have been good for us through that process.
One of the character traits you're looking for, really, though, is someone who's independent-minded. Is there just a way you can ask general questions trying to flesh out a prospective juror's independence?
Yeah. So in another case I had, we were picking the jury for a guy who was accused of having too much junk in his yard. He had a couple of acres, and he liked to fix lawnmowers and fix cars. So he had his 2 acres was fenced in and not visible to the public, but they were calling it a nuisance because he had all this stuff lying around in the yard. So I was asking questions about government control and government authority, and is it ever okay? How do you feel about private property rights? And is it ever okay for someone to challenge the government's ability to regulate their property? And there were a few responses to that. So then the government guy followed up and he said, raise your hand if you agree with this. I can do whatever I want on my own property as long as I'm not hurting anyone. And one guy who was all tattooed and pierced, he was all pierced and tattooed up, he kind of slowly raised his hand And of course, you know, of course he got struck first. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't have asked that question. Maybe I should have just left it, you know, because that opened the door to the government then following up and then striking what probably would have been the best juror for me in that case. You know, I think it's hard to find a good question because you're just going to open the door. You're going to open the door to the government finding, you know, worming out the ones they don't want on the panel.
Right. Okay. Well, let's go to the trial itself now. Just what we'll start off, first opportunity you have to at least try and plant the idea of jury nullification in the jurors' minds is the opening statement. What do you remember? Glenn Reynolds made the opening statement in your case, in the Hershberger case. What do you remember about that, or just what general guidelines did he follow trying to plant that thought in the jurors' minds?
Well, we worked and prepared for that for months. And I think the most important part of that opening statement was the video that we put together showing Vernon and members of his buying club, you know, making hay using draft horses and in the milking parlor, his children helping with the chores. All of these things were intended to tell a story of somebody who loves his animals and cares for the farm and provides good, clean food for people who need it and can't get access to it otherwise. That's the story we were presenting. We also staged the courtroom. Most people couldn't get seats in the courtroom, and we picked the ones that did. And the right in the front row were Vernon's 10 children with their little bib overalls and bonnets. And I think that's important. Is this somebody that needs to be sent to jail? Is the unspoken message.
Right.
Then the statement itself that Glenn gave, we were setting the stage for the evidence we were going to present and the story that we wanted to tell. And that's basically that these are not people who are just the same as Sam's Club members. These are people who live and breathe and work on this farm and help with food production. And they are owners. There's a lease document that creates an ownership interest under Wisconsin law. That was our story.
One thing that happened in the case, if you could bring it up a little now before continuing on with just the strategy during the trial, was that just one thing you can focus on is just basically effective or just law enforcement. Does it? Yeah, is what the department did promoting just and fair law enforcement. So there was actually an incident where they raided his farm and went into the room where his dairy bulk tank was. And could you just talk about what happened there and how you brought that up in what context during the trial?
That was another time when video was effective. Vernon and his sons and friends filmed almost every government encounter. So in this case, the inspector came in and determined that the bulk tank, the milk in the big tank where it's stored, had to be destroyed because raw milk was being distributed. And the video showed Vernon standing on one side watching her, and on the other side, two of his sons were just wide-eyed, looking scared and confused, silent and well-behaved like they always are. And the state inspector just had this really unpleasant expression, looked very threatening and unkind. And she just took, the video shows her taking dye and dumping it into this beautiful milk and destroying it. And the kids were just wide-eyed watching her do it. And you can just see they're thinking, why would you destroy this food that we worked so hard to produce? So I think that had a big impact on the jury. more so than the cross. We did, you know, cross-examine on technical stuff and legal issues, but I think that video is what really brought the jury around to seeing that this is government excess.
I think another thing you and Glenn tried to stress through the trial was that Vernon isn't any conscious lawbreaker. His motives and intent were good, and I think this has a little bit to do with the Amish tradition as well. So if you could discuss that a bit and how that played out.
Any chance we had to humanize Vernon and counter the government's theory that he was just someone who thought he was above the law, we took. The government also tried to portray him as making a huge profit off of illegal activities. I remember his testimony on that vividly. That was when Vernon was testifying, and the government had, he had handwritten on his summaries, he had a cash register summary each day, and he would handwrite net, that this was net revenue. And it was a big number. But in fact, his actual income was quite low, well below the poverty level. And in fact, that was a gross, those numbers were gross receipts, not net receipts. So the government made the mistake of hammering on that and saying, and trying to show the jury, look how much money this guy is raking in. And when we talked to Vernon, we realized that he just didn't understand the difference between net and gross. He didn't know what that meant. And so Glenn asked him, you know, these numbers reflect one day's worth, you know, each day's worth of cash register receipts. Is that correct? Yes. And then he said, does this number reflect your receipts before or after expenses? And Vernon said, before expenses. And Glenn said, well, then why did you write net on the receipt? And Vernon said, I guess that's just my eighth grade education. And that seems like that really won over the jury. I mean, Vernon's pretty charming anyway, but he was very self-deprecating, not at all arrogant, very respectful. And, you know, I think the jury just really loved him at the end of the trial.
Yeah, let's get more into just the presenting of the evidence during the trial. One of the things I remember about the store was he had all these prices on just about every item, but Glenn explain the prices by saying people didn't necessarily pay what was on the price, and just kind of got it out of this idea that it was a regular commercial store. So yeah, if you could explain the argument there.
We had did a lot of witness preparation in this case, and we interviewed probably 30 to 40 of Vernon's club members to determine which ones would make the best witnesses. And one was a single mother of four, very low income, and she didn't pay anything for her food because she couldn't afford it. There was, and the other members agreed to that. It's just people paid what they could afford. Some, so the, our witnesses explained that the prices were guidelines. If you couldn't pay that much, then you didn't. And if you could pay more to support the other members, then you did. And we had one of the wealthier couples, we had that person testify that they always paid more. That was just the philosophy of the community.
So this gets into just what is called the shadow defense, just a way to get the jury thinking about nullification, even though the law and the facts might not be the defendant's favor. And it happens in instances where they're not real comfortable, I guess, just convicting someone like Vernon, who, as you said, was just providing all this healthy food to hundreds of people. But they want something, you have to give the jury something to hang their hat on. Just, you can't just say, no, he didn't have a retail food establishment, or he wasn't a milk producer under the law. So you've already addressed it somewhat, but if you get into, the different ways you did give the jury something to hang their hat on, if when it was probably apparent to you, you weren't real comfortable convicting him.
Right. Studies have shown that most people are not comfortable defying a judge's instructions. It just takes them out of their comfort zone. So what I call, what you're referring to as the shadow defense, or what I call the straw man defense, is a technique of saying to the jury, in effect, look, here's a reason why an acquittal would still fall within the instructions you've received from the judge. You're not defying the law. So that's why we first try to humanize Vernon and make him a sympathetic character so that the jury wants to acquit. And then the next step is we have to give them a legal basis for making that determination that falls within what the judge has instructed. That's why the jury instructions are so crucial. And as an aside, we lost almost everything we tried to get in those instructions, but we were able to call to the witness stand the non-lawyer who drafted the lease document that all of Vernon's private club members signed. So we had his testimony, and I have to say it was not a well-drafted document, so we had to work around that, but it was intended to create an ownership interest in the farm. So we presented that, we presented the person who drafted it to express the intent of the drafting, and then in closing we were able to make a legal argument that the members of the buying club were in fact owners of the farm, and therefore there was no license required for them to acquire the food products from the farm. Not a particularly strong legal argument, but it's a hook to hang a hat on. That was the intent.
And
it worked.
From what I remember, you also called Vernon as a witness during the trial, correct?
Yeah, we did.
So, yeah, a lot of criminal defense lawyers would not do that, or at least in most cases, wouldn't call the defendant to the stand. So what was your thinking behind putting Vernon on the stand?
Well, you know, you don't want to call generally the defendant. Well, it varies. Sometimes you almost have to call the defendant as a witness in a self-defense case. You have to call them. So there's numerous exceptions to the general rule of not calling the defendant. The risk you take is that he's got to tell the truth, and so then you open up to the prosecution asking questions that put him at risk. In this case, we didn't really have anything to hide. Everything that he was doing was out there in the public domain, and he had given interviews, laid everything out. He had been on television several times. So we didn't really have anything to hide. Everything was already out in the public domain. And we thought that we could do a lot of good because of his charm and character.
I want to get back to just this court of public opinion aspect. Well, again, while you were going through, this was a 5-day trial, believe it or not, it was 3 misdemeanors and 1 felony, if I remember right. Or was it?
They were all misdemeanors.
All misdemeanors. So 4 misdemeanors. It was a 5-day trial. But what happened? You mentioned one thing that happened, just the local merchants helping out during the trial. Just what I remember about that trial is just, you've got your community. He had his community in Sauk County, but he also had just a national community come in, other farmers who'd faced enforcement actions like Joel Saladin, Mark Baker, Alvin Schlangen. And yeah, do you think that had any, somehow the jury got wind of that? Do you think that had an impact at all on the jury and was at least somewhat of a factor in convincing them to nullify? Or just what do you think the benefits of that, what happened during the trial?
It's always beneficial, I tell my clients, to have to pack a courtroom and to have strong community support. I don't know how aware the jury was of the national implications, but they certainly were aware that there were hundreds of people on the courthouse steps listening to speeches and holding signs and supporting Vernon. So yeah, I mean, that has to be impactful. And I think some of the jurors who spoke out after the trial did say that, you know, that just made them curious. They're not allowed to Google anything or look anything up, but they can see that this is not a typical license violation case.
Okay.
All right. So we're at the closing argument right now. And just one of the important things about the jury is they're supposed to be the conscience of the community. And they're supposed to judge the evidence, but they're also supposed to vote their conscience when they make their decision. So how did just Glenn Reynolds appeal to that aspect when he made his final argument?
He started with, again, humanizing Vernon and talking about, and without using the words, to somewhat vilify the government, to say that they were too harsh coming down in the way they were treating Vernon and that they were unfair, summarizing the evidence of destroying the milk and that sort of thing. And then I think his last line was one of the most powerful, when he's setting it up so that, first of all, there's no violation here because these are owners. And secondly, the government's overstepping. And thirdly, Vernon is just a hardworking farmer trying to feed his community. And then finally, he says, in the conscience, you know, trying to invoke the conscience argument, he said, you know, do the right thing. Send this man home to his family. And I think that was very powerful.
Right. He also had an interesting comparison to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, too. I think he compared them to Elliot Ness and the Untouchables. But instead of, conffiscating and dumping whiskey, they were dumping raw milk. I mean, there's testimony that they dumped 2,000 pounds, or actually put a toxic dye in 2,000 pounds of raw milk. So, what's your memory of that?
Well, I think you described it pretty accurately. And that's, that's another effective technique when you can invoke an image like that. And of course, Prohibition was a time when there was a great deal of jury nullification going on. And as you and I have discussed, a sure sign of an unjust law is one that is routinely violated by generally law-abiding people. And that's what happened in Prohibition, and that's what's happening in Wisconsin at the time of Vernon's trial and continuing today, is you have thousands of law-abiding people who are, the people aren't violating the law by drinking the milk, but it's not lawful for their farmers to sell it.
Right.
So I think it was an effective image to invoke the Prohibition era dumping.
Yeah, another effective image I thought he had was just portraying all the farm owners, people who'd signed this lease agreement, as members of a family. That was all a family. Because like you were saying earlier, the jury instructions you had were extremely unfavorable. This law on operating without a retail food establishment permit, if you actually look at the regulation, it says if you sell to consumers, you need a permit. But consumers is defined as members of the public. So you think that would maybe give Vernon some kind of out, but in the actual instructions, it didn't at all. Because the judge just said, you're a member of the public, and basically, if you're not a family member, if you're not a member of Vernon's family, you're a member of the public. and Glenn Reynolds was able to just expand a family member into extended family. And yeah, these people do chores on the farm just like the family member does.
Yeah, we fought long and hard over that instruction and lost. But yeah, he did a good job of pulling that rabbit out of the hat.
There was another thing that was constantly at issue. I think DACAP was, or the state was constantly trying to get it disqualified as evidence, was anytime Glenn brought up that contract, because they, you know, were just the relationship between the Vernon and his club members. They, I guess, said that was a legal conclusion or something like that. So yeah, if you could speak to that, how you...
Well, that was one of the few things we won on. We were allowed to introduce it. We were allowed to take testimony from the person who drafted it. We were allowed to question Vernon about it. And we were allowed to question the members about their understanding of the meaning of it. All those things were allowed in over the state's objections. We didn't win on a lot, but we won on that. And that was probably the most important thing. So during deliberations, when the jury asked for a copy of the lease, I knew there was a good chance we won, that they were going for the straw man.
Right. So yeah, just kind of the postscript to this, I think I mentioned it in the other podcast, was that three of the jurors actually joined Vernon's Food Buyers Club after the trial. But it was...
Yeah, the state, in its effort to curtail raw milk sales, the state actually created three new followers. All of them said they had never even heard of raw milk. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know it was a thing. But after going through the trial, then they did some research and decided that was something that they wanted to participate in.
Right. So just, I think we agree that with the increasing government power these days, just the decline in the rule of law, that just jury nullification is one of the most important civic duties an American can exercise right now. Just if you could, yeah, just put in your words, someone gets a summons to serve on a jury, just if you could describe what you think the importance of it is.
As I said earlier, the framers of the Constitution intended that the purpose of the jury would be to guard against the exercise of arbitrary power. The jury, back in colonial times, there was a small circle of wealthy, powerful people, not unlike the situation we have today. And sometimes, oftentimes, laws tend to favor that small group. So it's the province of and the purpose of the jury to keep that at bay. So it's very important to know, as a juror, to know your power and to exercise it. That's the only way we can curtail the power of government to institute and maintain unjust laws.
Right. Okay, any final comments? I guess one thing we both agree on is that these states have the right to pass laws just requiring the judge to tell the jury that they can judge not only the facts, but the law of the case. So it seems like the legislature, this work on jury nullification is not only for the courts, but for the legislature right now.
Perhaps. I think especially for the courts, because what we have in Wisconsin and in the U.S. Supreme Court is a distinct majority of justices who proclaim that they are originalists in terms of constitutional construction. And if in fact they are originalists, they should favor jury nullification or jury independence. And they should institute, I think, a rule that doesn't keep that power a secret, that doesn't permit a court to keep it a secret. So I would like to see some cases go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'd like to see the issue addressed, because I personally favor jury independence, and I think it's a cornerstone of our republic. So I'd like to see it taken up by these justices who proclaim that they are originalists. If they are, in fact, originalists, I don't see how they can decline to promote jury independence.
Just one last comment from you on the Hershberger case. I mean, you've litigated dozens of cases over the years. It just seems Vernon was actually convicted on one of the four charges that we didn't bring up, just violating this holding order not to remove product from refrigerators that had been in freezers that had been taped. But the key was, because he was innocent on the other three charges, he was able to continue doing what he wanted to do, continuing to provide food for his family. And just, yeah, what was it like when you actually got the verdict? And when you reflected on the case since, what come to your mind?
When the verdict was received, it was a pretty triumphant moment. There was a lot of emotion because, you know, Vernon put himself out there for the greater cause of food freedom. And he did so at great risk of being imprisoned. And he's the sole support of his family of 12. So it was pretty courageous of him to do it. And it was also a lot of stress and pressure on the entire family. So it was a beautiful thing to see, that family relief when he was told that he wasn't going to go to jail. They did impose a fine for the one guilty verdict of $1,500, which the Buyers Club members put up immediately. So that was also kind of gratifying. But, you know, the bigger picture, even though this was a trial court level decision that doesn't carry any precedential weight, I think it certainly had a huge impact. I'm not aware that any raw milk enforcement action has been brought in Wisconsin since that case. And I think it was, even nationally, just a big victory for food freedom.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the way things are now, just with the conventional food supply just deteriorating in quality, that it's something. Just a Vernon, basically, there was no permit for what he wanted to do. So more of these cases might come up, because I think more people are going to go buying directly from the farm, and the industry will look at that as unwanted competition, I think, even though they brought a lot of it on by themselves through the difficulties they're having. And there might be more cases like this where the law doesn't exactly support what's going on, where people are to protect their food supply. They're going to need to, there could be other times where jury nullification would be needed to keep the supply going in the community or region. All right. Well, hopefully we've educated the viewers by going through this trial. You actually litigated on it. Before we go, just if you could give people your contact information for both the nonprofits I mentioned earlier, Andrew's Voice, and also Food Freedom Foundation.
Sure. Thanks, Pete. The Food Freedom Foundation can be found at www.foodfreedomfoundation.org. Andrew's Voice is another nonprofit advocating for civil liberty. That is www.andrewsvoice.org.
Is there a phone number if people want to contact either of those organizations?
Andrew's Voice is 920-838-2828. And we're actually in the process of porting over the Food Freedom Foundation's number to a different one. So in the interim, that people can call 920-838-2828. Both of those go directly to me. And I'm the president of both organizations.
You've got a lot of hats, wearing a lot of hats these days. But yeah, just Elizabeth Rich, you've left quite a legacy in this area, and you're not done yet. And just advancing the cause of food rights. And those who know you are very appreciative of the work you've done. So thanks for being on the podcast, and take care.
Thanks, Pete.